Tomorrow is Mother's Day, as has already been mentioned. I'd like to thank Leif for using one of the mothers as an example that I'm not going to use. I decided kind of at the last minute to take her out, and now I understand why. So thank you very much, Leif, for that. Mother's Day, it's a national holiday, as we know. It has its roots, interestingly enough, in that horrible conflict that we call the Civil War. The first celebration took place in 1908 in West Virginia and Philadelphia, and it became a national day under President Wilson in 1914, the year that another terrible war began that would deprive millions of mothers of their sons. Ironically, the founder or leading campaigner for that particular day was a woman named Anna Maria Jarvis, and later she tried to rescind the holiday because, in her opinion, it had become too commercialized, even back in the early 1900s. It seems the florists, the confectioners, and the card makers were raking in the profits, and that is not what she wanted the day to be about. They even created a new color of carnation. Did you know that? You can change the color of carnations or create the color of carnations. I don't know how they did it, but anyway, the red carnation was created specifically for sales on Mother's Day, and it did really, really well. Mrs. Jarvis, on the other hand, spent her last days in a mental institution, and legend has it, I was never able to confirm this, legend has it that all the costs were paid by a group of florists in a macabre thanks for what she had done for them. Now, that's a short history of Mother's Day. Interesting. But I'd like to springboard from that to some questions. What do mothers in the Bible do? What do mothers in the Bible do? How is motherhood expressed in Scripture? Who are some examples of mothers in the Bible? What can we learn from them? And more importantly, what is the spiritual application of all this? Is there a spiritual danger that we need to be aware of about this topic, possibly? Let's begin. Go ahead and start in Exodus 20. Exodus 20, verse 12. This is not the first mention of motherhood, but we're going to start here to lay some groundwork. Exodus 20, verse 12. You don't even need to turn there, I'm sure. You can all repeat it by heart. Honor your father and mother, that the days may be long in the land that the Lord your God gives you. Honor your father and mother, a command, one of the Ten Commandments, the basis of God's law. Notice it says father and mother. Even in a male-dominated society as ancient Israel and those around it, there was no hierarchy in this command. It doesn't say love your father more and then whatever you got left over, love your mother. Or honor your father more and whatever you got left over, honor your mother. No, it says honor them both. Turn to Exodus 21. Exodus 21 shows us a repetition of this idea. Exodus 21, verse 15. These are the lists of commands of civil penalties for various crimes. And there's a very interesting one here. Exodus 21, verse 15. Whoever strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death. Again, not if you strike your father, you're put to death. If you strike your mother, you lose a hand. That's not what God says. There's an equality here. Mothers are important in the eyes of God. They are equal to fathers in spiritual potential, even though they may have differing roles in the family and as cultures change, differing roles in society and cultures. So let's take a look at some of these roles. Some descriptions of motherhood that define actions that are used to illustrate principles about the overall performance and involvement of mothers in a family. We're going to start in Proverbs 31. You can go ahead and turn there, probably keep a finger there or a bookmark there because we'll be going back and forth through it. And I chose Proverbs 31 because it provides a convenient structure for everything else that we're going to be talking about. So we'll be dipping in and out of Proverbs 31, but I'll be using that as the scaffold on which the rest of this is going to be constructed. We all know Proverbs 31 is the proverb about a virtuous woman, a poem of praise to women that is still an important part of ritual in many Jewish households today. Let's look at this for a few principles. See what they mention, and we're going to find some confirmation of these principles in other scriptures. So let's go ahead and start. Proverbs 31, we're going to start while it's at verse 15. Proverbs 31, verse 15, talks about some of the things that this virtuous woman does. She rises while it is yet night, provides food for her household, and portions for her maidens. Point number one, a mother gives life. A mother gives life. If you want confirmation of that, turn back to Genesis 3, verse 20. Genesis 3, verse 20. Here, at the beginning of life, at the beginning of creation, we have the garden, we have God, we have Adam and Eve. Sorry, we have Adam to begin with, and then we have Eve. And we know her as Eve. However, her name in Hebrew is slightly different. But we'll get into this if we look at Genesis 3, verse 20, where Adam finally mentions her name. She's been around for a little bit, and it says he called her Eve, or in Hebrew, he called her Chava, which is because she is the mother of all living. She is the mother of all living. She gave life to everyone. Think about it, if you will. Think about the most accomplished men in the world that you've ever heard of, or that you might know in your life. Albert Einstein, Alexander the Great, Plato, Mozart, Monet, Churchill, whoever you can think of. Whatever field of endeavor you wish to look, they all have one thing in common. You know what that is? They were all born by a woman. Every single one of them had a mother. All that greatness that you can think of, the sum total of these people, these men and what they've accomplished, and women too, obviously, they all had mothers. That life came from a mother. Having a mother is so important to the life-giving process that even God chose for his son to have a mother. Think about that. He could have just, poof, showed up. He didn't. He went through the birth process. Even the Son of God had a mother. Let's look at Genesis 4. We're going to stay in Genesis for a moment here. Look in Genesis 4, verses 1 and 2, where it says, "Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, 'I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord.' And again, she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain was a worker of the ground." That's an interesting phrase. I have gotten a man from the Lord. I have gotten a man from the Lord. The word is kana, and it means to create, or to build, or to put together. But it's used for the word create. And this is the only time in the entire scriptures that this word is used for birth. Even the next sentence down where it says she bore Abel, that's the normal word for birth. So there was something remarkable about this first birth of Cain that required a different word. It's kana, to create. This word is also used in Genesis 14, verses 19 and 20. This word is used by Melchizedek when he's speaking of God the Most High, and he calls him the possessor or the creator of heavens and earth. He uses the same word there. Now, this is not meant to lead to some strange theory of apotheosis of Eve. Genesis is not a biology textbook, I understand, but it's a literary way of crediting Chava, that's Eve, a word which derives from the Hebrew word for life, l'chaim. It's a way of crediting her and her role as the first mother, the first human giver of life. Notice also, she names her children, not Adam. She does. And in many verses, the Hebrew wives name their children. Hebrew mothers name their children. This signifies authority over, control over the children. Also, we can go back to the creation account. Maybe not the most positive example, but interesting nonetheless. The first instance of procuring and feeding of food is here in Genesis as well, when Eve takes the apple and hands it to her husband, Adam, and he eats. This is the first instance of a woman performing that role. Now, when Adam takes that fruit, is he thereby acknowledging her role and submitting to her as the one who provides the food for the family? I think that lesson is there. Now, admittedly, it was a bad choice, but it still outlines the biblical role of a mother to feed and nourish her family. A mother gives life. Does that mean that wives should do all the cooking? No, of course not. That would be an incredibly shallow interpretation, and I'm sure we're not going there. But it does, on a higher level, mean that mothers give life to the household, life and nourishment. It can be food, it can be instruction, and it can certainly be attitudes and ways of thinking. And remember, to do this, especially before the baby is born, to do this, a mother self-sacrifices to provide this life. The nutrients that make up the baby come from the mother's body, and they take a toll on the woman's body. She literally gives of herself to provide life for others. So a mother is worthy of honor because she gives life. Cherish her. Cherish her. Write that word down, cherish. Proverbs 31:16. Let's go back to Proverbs. Proverbs 31:16. Here's another thing that this virtuous woman does, and because we've already established she's got children, we will refer to her as the virtuous mother. Proverbs 31:16. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hand, she plants a vineyard. What's she doing here? She's expanding the household. She's expanding what the husband, the children, their opportunities, what they own. A mother expands the household. Expands the household. We get a glimpse of this in Genesis 24, verses 46 and 58. You don't need to turn there. This is a story about how the servant finds a wife for Isaac. It turns out to be Rebecca. And there's some interesting things about Rebecca's personality, I think. I think she was a rather assertive young lady, and good for her. I'm reminded of the time when, towards the end of the story, when Rebecca's riding on the camel and they see Isaac coming across the field, she doesn't just kind of sit there and wait for him to show up. She jumps off the camel, throws her veil around her face, and goes trucking out to meet him. She's not afraid. She's an assertive young woman, and very good for her. Her family wanted her to stay 10 extra days after the servant came there. And she said, nah, I'm good. Let's go. Let's go. Later, she conspires to send Jacob back to her relatives to get him a wife. She wants to expand the household. The household of her husband Isaac, and of course, the new household of Jacob as well. Both Leah and Rachel take on this role as well. Granted, in a rather odd, competitive way, considering the way we look at things, but this was normal for their time and in society, by producing children through their maids with Jacob. In the book of Ruth, Naomi undertakes this role as well. She instructs Ruth how to proceed with her approach to Boaz, a way to keep the inheritance in her household, a way to expand the opportunities of the household for all three of them. And let me introduce you to another mother. Her name is Marie-Madeleine Fourcade. She was a young single mother in France in the late 1930s and 40s. In 1940, France fell to the Nazis, and Marie-Madeleine left Paris, like many other people, fled to southern France, and immediately began to work on a special project that would normally have made her famous. But this was wartime. And actually, only in the last 10 years or so have some of the documents involving her been declassified. It turns out that this young, single mother operated the largest and most successful French resistance movement during the entire war. Her organization was responsible for sending thousands of bits of important and classified information to the British. She was able to do this despite intensive searches by the Gestapo and the other secret police forces of the Nazis, and her tireless efforts and their tireless efforts to close her down and kill her. How? A mother expands her household. Her organization was always growing. New agents were always being recruited. And when one cell would get shut down, new ones would spring up nearby, all managed by a young single mother in her 30s. A mother expands her household. Respect her. She expands her household. Respect her. If you're taking notes, write down the word respect. A mother gathers and protects. A mother gathers and protects. Turn to Hosea 13, verse 8, please. Hosea chapter 13, verse 8. God is talking about protecting Israel. And he says this, "I will fall upon them, the enemies, like a bear robbed of her cubs. I will tear open their breasts and I will devour them like a lion, as a wild beast would rip them open." How many of you have ever gotten between a mother bear and its cubs? None of you, because you're all still here and alive. And if you had, that probably wouldn't be the case. Mothers can be very protective. Mothers can be very protective. In Proverbs 31, verse 21, talking about that virtuous mother again, it says, "She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household are clothed in scarlet." All her household are clothed in scarlet. She's protected them against the elements. Matthew 23, verse 37. This is a comment from Jesus as he's nearing the end of his earthly life. Matthew 23, verse 37. He's looking out over the city of Jerusalem and he says, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under its wings, and you were not willing." A mother hen is very protective. It has a special call that all of her chicks recognize. Now, I grew up raising chickens, and I know different chickens had different things and different calls. I could never tell the difference between one mother or the other and which call she was making, but her chicks certainly did. All sounded like the same to me, but they can hear the difference. She makes this clucking noise and all the chicks come running, but only her chicks and other chickens' chicks don't come. They go somewhere else from a very similar sounding clucking noise. She covers them with her wings and hides them from predators, protects them from the rain, and keeps them warm in the cold. Isaiah 66, verse 13. Isaiah 66, verse 13. "As one whom his mother comforts, so I will comfort you. You shall be comforted in Jerusalem." Again, God talking about a future for Israel. He comforts like a mother. A mother comforts. A mother gathers and a mother protects. Mr. Corellison has already mentioned Moses' mother, but in Exodus 2, verse 2, we see the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. For 3 months, this woman defied the power of the most powerful empire on the earth at that time. She defied the power of the state to protect her son. 1 Kings chapter 1. We're not going to turn there, but I want to lay a context for you. 1 Kings chapter 1 is about how one of the sons of David, near the end of David's life, his son Adonijah, plots to assume the throne from his father. Solomon was the one that David was going to designate. He didn't get around to designating him for whatever reason. And Solomon's mother, Bathsheba, is involved in the court intrigue that turns the tables on Adonijah. And you all know the story. Adonijah's throwing a big party. "Hey, I'm going to be king," yada, yada, yada. And then David changes things and puts Solomon on the throne in his place. So with that in mind, let's look at the next chapter. when Adonijah again begins to lay plans for a future on the throne for himself. And this conversation, I think, reads like a dialogue from the Game of Thrones. And I'd like you to approach it that way. This is a political dialogue. This is not just a conversation between a man who wants a wife and somebody who thinks he can get it for him. This is a political point-counterpoint. 1 Kings 2, verses 13 through 23. Then Adonijah, son of Haggith, came to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, and she said, "Do you come peacefully?" You can see that tension already is there. He knocks on the door, or he's announced, or however it was that he approaches, and she's concerned. "Are you coming peacefully?" He's a man of war. He's a full-grown man. He wanted to become king. It didn't work out. What's going on here? She's an astute woman. She knows that there's this interplay going on. She says, "Are you coming peacefully?" And he says, "Peacefully." He's got something he wants. There's something going on here. He's not just coming by to say, "Hey, how you doing?" Then he said, "I have something to say to you." Obviously, you don't just show up, you know, in front of the mother of the king without something. So, "I have something to say to you." Now Bathsheba is starting to get a little bit nervous, maybe. Maybe not nervous. She's subtle. She's wise. All she does is say it. No commitment. I can see a placid face. No sort of relief. Oh, he's not going to kill me. No, none of that. Just, say it. Speak. He said, "You know that the kingdom was mine. All Israel fully expected me to reign." Putting himself up there, showing where he's got some power. Probably some people in Israel still want him to become king. He's reminding her of all these political forces going on. "However, the kingdom has turned about and become my brother's, for it was from the Lord. It was his from the Lord." Now he's kind of saying, "Yeah, that's okay. It was God's doing. You know, this. I'm just going along with what God wants. This is great. It's for the best." All those sort of things. "And now I have one request to make from you, and do not refuse me." And she said to him, again, she knows. She's totally noncommittal. She says, "Oh yeah, great idea. What do you want? No. She says, "Speak. Tell me, what do you want?" And he said, "Please ask King Solomon, and he will not refuse you, you're his mother, to give me Abishag, the Shunammite, as my wife." Bathsheba said, and I'm sure at this point, I'm sure she arched an eyebrow, at least internally, probably did not show it on her face. She knows what this request means. She's a smart woman. And I wonder how hard it was to act to, "I'm just going to pretend I'm the dumb woman here, I don't know what's going on. Yeah, okay, whatever, I'll ask him." How does she do that? I don't know. "Very well," she says, "I will speak for you to the king. I will speak in your place for the king." I may be wrong, but I don't believe for a minute that Bathsheba is being innocent or deceived or gullible here. She knows exactly what this request means, and she is quite willing to do what she needs to do to protect her son. Because guess what? The only way she can protect her son from this is to tell him what's going on. And it's obvious what the answer is, or his reaction is going to be. So Bathsheba went to King Solomon to speak to him on behalf of Adonijah. And the king rose to meet her and bowed down to her. And he sat on his throne, and he had a seat brought in for the king's mother, and she sat on his right. And then, after all this sort of ceremony is done, he stands up, he bows to her, he brings her in, he puts her to the right. She can't sit on his throne. He's the king. She's got to sit over here. That's the place of honor. Probably a little lower throne because he's still the king, but she's his mother. All this ceremony going on, and then she says, "Make your request, my mother, for I will not refuse you." And she said, and I don't know how she said this. Did she have a smile on her face? Did she have one eyebrow raised? But she's telling him, your brothers plotting to overthrow you again. And here's what she says. She said, let Abishag the Shunammite be given to Adonijah, your brother, as wife. She said exactly what she had told Adonijah she would say. She didn't lie to him. She didn't deceive him. She said, yeah, I'll tell the king you want to do this. So she did. King Solomon answered his mother, and why do you ask Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask him for the kingdom also, for he is my older brother, and on his side are Abiathar the priest and Joab the son of Zeruiah. And the king Solomon swore by the Lord, saying, God do to me, and more so also, if this word does not cost Adonijah his life. And he went out, and he had Adonijah killed for his attempt to overthrow Solomon. Bathsheba protected her son. A mother gathers and protects, so defend her. A mother gathers and protects, so defend her. You can write that defend down if you wish. Proverbs 31, verse 1. Go back to Proverbs again. Proverbs 31, verse 1. The words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. An oracle, a teaching, a saying that his mother taught him. It's the mother that is teaching the king here. A mother teaches or instructs. She's involved in the lives of her children. What did David ever tell his son that we have recorded anyway? I mean, I'm sure there's lots more, so I don't want to go too far with this example, but we've got this whole proverb about what a king's mother teaches her son. What did David ever tell his son? Go kill these people over here, and these people over here treat nicely. That's all we've got recorded, basically, from David to Solomon. There's a lot more from the mother. Now, if this King Lemuel is Solomon, which probably a good probably a good chance that he is, that would make the mother who's doing the talking here Bathsheba. And what is it she says first? What is it she says to her son first? Don't chase women. Don't chase women. This is a repeat of an instruction in Deuteronomy 17, verse 17, where God is listing out the duties and the requirements and the responsibilities of a king, and he says, and he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he require for himself excessive gold and silver. So the first thing, don't take a lot of wives. Now, considering Bathsheba's history and how she became one of David's wives, this is particularly touching, I think. Don't chase women. A mother teaches. We see this idea of teaching expanded in Titus, chapter 2, verse 3. Titus chapter 2, verse 3, where Paul commands, older women likewise be reverent in behavior, not slanderers or slaves to much wine. They are to teach what is good and to train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be good mothers, in other words, to be virtuous mothers, to be self-controlled, pure, working at home, kind, submissive to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be reviled. But the older women, the older mothers are to teach. Maybe this is why we have this interesting verse over in Proverbs. You drop back to Proverbs 29, verses 15 and 17. Proverbs 29, verses 15 and 17. A rod and a reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to whom? Not to the father. It says a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. When the wicked increase, transgression increases, but the righteous will look upon their downfall. Discipline your son, and he will give you rest. He will give you delight to your heart. But if you leave him alone, he brings shame to his mother. Interesting. Interesting. Not the father. Although, obviously, we would hope a father would be ashamed as well of a child that errs. That's not the point. The point is there's this connection between the instruction and the mother. Now, we're not assigning specific roles here. We're just acknowledging the impact and the importance in the Bible that mothers have across a wide range of areas. We're doing that for a purpose, which we will come to at the end. But to continue with teaching, 2 Timothy 1, verse 5. 2 Timothy 1, verse 5. Paul writing to Timothy, telling him in one of the pastoral epistles how to be a pastor, how to manage churches. And he says in 2 Timothy 1, verse 5, I'm reminded of your sincere faith, a faith that dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and now I am sure dwells in you as well. Where did Timothy get his faith? From his mother and from his grandmother. A mother teaches. A mother teaches. Attend to her words. Attend to her words. You can write down attend as well. Now, you might want to write them in different order because we're going to do something right here. We're going to recap. Because she gives life like Eve, we should cherish our mothers. You can write cherish down. Because she teaches like Bathsheba and many others, we should attend to her teaching. Listen. Because she expands the household, like Proverbs 31, or Rebecca, or Naomi, we should respect our mothers. And because she gathers and protects, like a mother bear or a hen, we should defend our mothers. Now, if you wrote all those words down, cherish, attend, respect, and defend, and you circle the first letter of each of those words, you have C-A-R-D. A Mother's Day card. How's that for cheesy? This is what each and every one of us owes our mothers. A simple card. But wait, there's more. For as you've probably noticed, there was one mother of whom we have not yet spoken. One mother who's not been the focus of our attention yet. And she is perhaps the most important mother of them all. For it is in her that we see the spiritual lessons come to life. Who is this mother? I hear whispers out there, people guessing things. Good guess, by the way. This mother is spoken of in a great work of prophetic significance. Turn to Revelation 12, please. Revelation 12, we're going to read verses 13 and 17. Revelation 12, verses 13 and 17. And when the dragon saw that he'd been thrown down to the earth, and we all know that's Satan, he pursued the woman. I should stop here and go back. There's a woman that starts off in this. She was protected from the dragon. He pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness to the place where she is to be nourished for a time and times and half a time. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. But the earth swallowed the river and the dragon had poured out from his mouth. Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. This woman had offspring. She is, by definition, therefore, a mother. Her offspring have two distinctive traits. They keep the commandments of God and they hold to the testimony of Jesus. Now let's add to that Galatians 4, verses 21 through 26. Galatians 4, verses 21 through 26. I'm going to focus on verse 26. This is the passage of Scripture where Paul is comparing Old Covenant and New Covenant. He's using the metaphor of Abraham and his two wives and the sons that came from them and what went to each of the sons. And he says in verse 25, now Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. She corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with the children. And in verse 26, he says, but the Jerusalem above is free, and she is our mother. The Jerusalem above is free, and she is our mother. Finally, let's go to Hebrews chapter 12, verse 22 and 23. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 22 and 23. We're focusing in, we're defining who this mother is. We're about to reveal who this mother is. But you have come to Mount Zion, and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. Okay, we've heard about the Jerusalem from above, is our mother. We're talking about the same thing, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven. The Jerusalem above that is free, the heavenly Jerusalem, and the church, the general assembly, are the same thing. The church is a spiritual mother. That's right. God is the Father, Jesus Christ the firstborn, our elder brother, and the church is our mother. Now, of course, I do not mean, and the Bible does not mean, that this is limited to one specific corporate legal man-designed entity. We're talking about the grand body of believers, those who hold to the commandments of God and the testimony of Jesus. We don't have time to go into the details of all of that. I will leave it to you to define for you what church, the church, means, because the definition is not too important to what follows. We are acknowledging, however, that the church, however we define that, is our mother. If you want to be a follower of Jesus, you will be a part of the church. You cannot be a follower of Jesus without a mother. There are no independent Christians. A son without a mother is an orphan. And as we saw in Proverbs, a son that grows up in his own way is a shame to his mother. Therefore, since the church is our mother, what should it be doing? What should the church be doing? Well, the same thing that our physical mothers do, and that we've gone through above. The church gives life. It provides sustenance. In spite of all the squabbling that went on between the apostles, there was one thing that was clear to them all. Yeah, maybe other things, but one thing that I'm going to point out for purposes of this sermon that was clear to them all. We see that in John chapter 6. John chapter 6, we're going to go to the end of the chapter. This is after the feeding of the 5,000. And then some very difficult sayings on the part of Jesus. Difficult sayings about who he was, what our responsibility is, how we should act. And they're called difficult by John himself. And he records that many of Jesus' followers stopped following him because of these sayings. And so Jesus turned and asked the 12, "What about you? Are you leaving too?" Simon Peter answered for them all, and he said, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life." The church's job is to teach those words, the life-giving word of the Holy Scriptures, to present Jesus' words accurately and appropriately for our times. The church, our spiritual mother, should give this life. But it should also provide physical sustenance to those who need it, food, shelter, etc. In Acts 2, verse 46, we see that there was a daily gathering of the followers of Jesus after his death. They gathered in the temple courts for instruction, to see each other, to talk, and then later on at each other's homes. They ate together. This is also the responsibility of the body of believers, the church. The church gives life, just like our physical mothers do. The church should expand the household. The church should expand the household. As we saw in Proverbs 31, the virtuous woman makes plans and moves forward with expanding the household. Naomi gave Ruth instructions on how to do the same thing. The church has the responsibility to grow, to make plans, and to adapt to those whom God is calling. We saw in John 6 that sometimes change is difficult. Verse 65 specifically says, "This is why I have told you no man can come to me unless the Father draws him." Some truths are difficult. Some change is difficult. The church, as our spiritual mother, should expand the household. The church should gather and protect her children. I am personally so appreciative of the fact that we have a congregation here in Manassas, a place where we can gather with people of mostly like mind. And that's good that we're mostly of like mind, not entirely 100% in lockstep. After 20 plus years of moving around the world with my family, in places where there was no congregation, this has been a blessing. Even in a small congregation such as ours, we have different life experiences, different approaches, different points of view. And I love the fact that if somebody disagrees with something I say up here, they can feel free to come up to me afterwards and tell me about it. And that's great, because I learn that way. We all learn that way. We all make mistakes. We all need to improve. I love the fact that we can gather together here or at feast sites, or the kids can go to camp, or a host of other activities that the church provides. We can build bonds by sharing time and experiences. I am happy to see that this responsibility was exercised recently as well in Haiti, where we were able to move our brethren there from where they were living to a safer location. Now, who knows how long that will stay safe? Who knows how long they will need continued support? Perhaps forever. Perhaps forever. But that's our job. And it is, as that little group grows, that job will grow too. And if there are others of like mind who need that help, hopefully we'll be wise and compassionate enough to allow them to join and provide for them as well. The church's responsibility is to gather and protect her children. The church's responsibility is to teach, just like Solomon's mother. Go back to Proverbs 31. Go back to Proverbs 31. We're going to go to the very first part of this chapter. The words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him, or a teaching that his mother taught him. What are you doing, my son? What are you doing, son of my womb? What are you doing, son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. We've gone through some of this before. But think of it now as a warning against false religion. The Bible depicts religion as women in Revelation and in other parts. So part of the job of our spiritual mother, the church, is to warn us about false religion, to encourage true worship as being better than the alternative. And we know true religion, undefiled, is to look after the widows, the orphans, etc., as James tells us. But she also says, don't give your ways to those who destroy kings. Now, part of this is a repeat of the women, because they led Solomon astray and many other kings astray. But what is it that destroys kings? Are there other things? Have you ever asked yourself that question? I never had until I started looking at this one. What destroys kings? But think about the greatest kings you know from history. Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, I don't know who else. Okay, Louis XIV, Ramses II. What brought them down? What destroyed them? Well, we're given a glimpse in Deuteronomy 17. We've touched on this. We'll go back there. Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 through 20, where God goes through the responsibilities of a king from the time when Israel decided they wanted a king. And God says in verse 14, when you come to the land of the Lord your God has given you, and you possess it and dwell in it, then and say, I will set up a king over me like all the nations that are around me. You may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. And he goes through a list of limitations on those kings. And he said, only he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. We've touched on that one. Nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests, and it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. So what are the things that destroy kings? How about the acquiring of many horses? What does that mean? Well, in ancient times, horses equal power. Solomon and other kings of Israel and Judah made tons of money trading and raising horses. It was the international arms trade of the day. The best horses came from Egypt and southeastern Turkey. It's notable that King Ahab, in the Battle of Karkar in 853 BC, had the second largest chariot force in this coalition that was successful in stopping the Assyrian Empire, at least for a time. So they had horses and they had chariots. What destroys a king? Seeking power. Seeking power. But let's look at the rest of that verse. He shall not make the children return to Egypt. Don't think about this as just a physical presence of going back down to Egypt. Return to Egypt meant slavery. What he's talking about here is selling Israelites off into slavery in trade for horses, or maybe sending them down as mercenaries for military service into Egypt in trade for horses. In essence, return to Egypt in the Bible signifies three things. Signifies in general a rejection of God's leadership, a desire to return to a life of bondage, a lack of faith in God's provision, and ultimately symbolizing the human inclination to cling to old ways instead of embracing new beginnings. What destroys a king? Seeking power, especially at the expense of his countrymen. What is the role of our mother, the church? Warning against the quest for power, especially within the church itself. Wives, you shall not acquire many wives. Wives turn aside the heart from following God. We saw this with Solomon. His diplomatic marriages brought foreign gods into Jerusalem. So in our analogy, we're again at false religion. The church is to guard against the seductive false teachings and ways and approaches. But let's expand this a little bit by asking two questions. Because it's easy to signal out false religion. But are there other seductive forces in the world around us? Well, yes, of course, we know that. Genesis 3 tells us Satan's the serpent. Sin can be very seductive, no matter what form it takes. So let me ask another question. What did false religion look like in ancient times? Or religion in general, for that matter? Well, first of all, there was not the same sharp distinction back then between religion and the rest of your life. They were all intertwined. Interestingly, archaeology has shown that there are certain characteristics, however, to cultic spaces, spaces that were used for worship in the ancient Near East. Certain characteristics. So I'm going to go through some of those, and I want you to think about them. These spaces were designed to put you in a receptive state of mind. They were the crossing point, it was believed, between the mundane world and the world of the gods. It's called a liminal space. That's a term that was used for them. They shared these characteristics. And I'll never forget when I first heard this list of characteristics and what popped into my mind. So let's see if the same thing happens for you. They were built in prominent areas, larger in size usually than the buildings around them, usually better quality construction. They were prominent. There was limited access. There was a special way you had to enter. Sometimes you would go straight in. Sometimes you would have to turn either to the left or to the right. But there was controlled or ritualized access. Often, there was special food. There was low lighting. Very few windows have ever been found in ancient temples. Finally, there was a single area of focus. When you got in, there was one area where you were to focus on, and that was usually on a raised platform. Does that remind you of anything in our modern life? First thought that went through my mind that day in class was, my professor has just described a movie theater. A movie theater. You got special food. You got the popcorn. You have to follow those little lines and tell you where those little standards and show you where to go. You got to go into the right room. And when you get in that room, the whole end of it's this big space with low lighting that you are focused on. And it's raised, so you're looking up, especially if you're sitting in the front, which I don't advise you do. You get dizzy. Or maybe a sports stadium. Maybe a sports stadium, a concert venue. Do you know why movies work? Because humans are easily convinced to suspend their disbelief. We go into a movie theater knowing that everything we see is fake. The blood's fake. The damage is fake. It's all done on computers now. You don't even have to crash the cars. Used to, you have to get real cars and crash them together. Now you don't even have to do that. Everything is fake, and yet we are willing to accept that what we are seeing is believable. Now, this is not to say that movies or concerts or sports games are worshiping Baal. Okay, I'm not saying that. But I think it is fair to say that our society does worship entertainment, in a sense that our lives are wrapped around the seeking of entertainment. It is so entwined with our lives, just like religion was in the past. We even have our little household shrines, computers. We have our little household rituals. It's called doom scrolling. Okay? So now you have an idea of what religion was like, what we call religion was like to the ancients. It was just another thing you did every day. And then some days you went to that special building with the big movie screen, not the movie screen, the big statue, and you had your religious services. But it was entwined in everything you do. And you also now have an idea of how intertwined with our lives seeking and witnessing for God should be. Back to Deuteronomy 17, verse 17b, the accumulation of worldly riches destroys kings. That's not to say wealth is a problem in itself, but we are obviously warned not to trust in worldly riches. What else destroys kings? If we go to verse 4, we see it's not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to take strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of the afflicted. King James Version says, lest they drink and forget the law. One reason to drink the pure water of the word is to remember the law. One sign of spiritual drunkenness is to forget the law. Do not be filled with the spirit of this world. Be set apart, sober-minded, not a base indulger in all that this world has to offer, but a discerning practitioner of God's ways. Other things our spiritual mother should teach, like Lemuel's mother taught him. Verse 8, open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Verse 9, open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. Not just those who are members of the church, but for all the needy and destitute. Our brothers and sisters in Haiti have already mentioned, talk about destitute. That's just one destitute country. But Myanmar, many parts of Africa, the Philippines, they're also fairly destitute. But also, what about the people in North Carolina who lost everything to a hurricane? Or those in California, those extremely wealthy people in California who lost everything they had to fires? They're destitute. They're as destitute as anybody else now. And more importantly, what about the emotionally or spiritually destitute? The church's job is to teach us to speak out for these, to teach us to do something about it. Judge righteously, fairly defend those who cannot defend themselves. Let's go to Proverbs 1, verses 7 through 9. Proverbs 1, verses 7 through 9 as we begin to wrap up here. Proverbs 1, verses 7 through 9 says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. My son, hear the instruction of your father, and forsake not the teaching or the law of your mother, for they shall be an ornament of grace unto your head and chains about their neck. I want to look at two words here, forsake. forsake not the law of your mother. It's a Hebrew word, natash, most often used when God is involved. When God says, I will not forsake you, I will never leave you. When the people of Israel say, God has forsaken us, this is the word that's the most often used. And it means to let go of, to cast aside, and it implies a conscious action, not just a simple forgetting, but a conscious action. So don't throw aside the teaching of your mother. We should not cast aside the teachings of our spiritual mother. Look at the word chains. It says those teachings are going to be chains about your neck. This word is the Hebrew word anak, and it's only used 3 or 4 times. It is something that goes around the neck. And we see in Judges chapter 8, verse 26, a second use of this word, where it's talking about how they robbed the Midianites of the gold bridles and reins that were used to guide their camels. So this anak thing is not just valuable, but it's also a system of control or direction. So let me read from out of the Passion Translation these same verses. I found this quite interesting. Pay close attention, my child, to your father's wise words, and never forget your mother's instructions, for their insight will bring you success, adorning you with grace-filled thoughts and giving you reins to guide your decisions. So those chains that it talks about, they're not just decoration. They're giving us reins to guide our decisions. Proverbs 6, 20 through 24, I think, cements this quite clearly. Proverbs 6, 20 through 24. My son, keep your father's commandment and forget not your mother's teaching. Bind them to your heart always. Tie them around your neck. When you walk, they will lead you. And when you lie down, they will watch over you. And when you awake, they will talk with you. So these commandments of your mother do lead. They do help us to make right decisions. The teaching of mothers is a light. A light shows you where to walk, but it is also a beacon that brings you home where you are lost. We've taken a look at Mother's Day. We've taken a look at our physical mothers, at biblical examples of what mothers do. We've taken a look at our own responsibilities towards our mothers. The church is our spiritual mother. We ought to cherish her, attend to her teaching. We ought to respect her and defend her as we would our physical mother. She deserves the same Mother's Day card. Tomorrow is Mother's Day. Your physical mother deserves recognition. Your spiritual mother, the church, also deserves recognition. This Mother's Day, let's take a moment to cherish, attend, respect, and always be ready to defend our mothers. That is the best Mother's Day card ever.